welcome, everyone. This is a teleconference in December of 2009, December 12th, on Pathwork Lecture 196, which is Commitment, Cause, and Effect. And I'm hoping that there might be more, you would be welcome if there are more questions. Don't ever want to put you on the spot. But these lectures are most effective when we use them to look at our personal realities and behavior, when we find the truth of them in our own lives. So there is a limit to how much objective teaching can be done. And perhaps another way to explain this is that what the Pathwork Guide teaches is a deeper level of truth than we are used to dealing with on a human level. And by that I mean that human beings look at the facts that are available, and we draw conclusions, and we try to find reasonable cause and effect, and we try to figure out what's going on based on the information that we have. Now, psychic abilities, intuition, New Age stuff did not start in the year 2000, and it didn't start in the 60s. It's been with humanity from the beginning, but it is not a science, it's an art, and it's tricky, because it depends totally upon the integrity of the person offering the observation or bringing forth a level of truth that cannot be proven. So when people say, what's going on in the room? You can look at facts. You can say, two people just walked in, three people are sitting down, and there's a mouse in the room, and that's creating some tension. And that may be all true. And there are dynamics going on in the people themselves. There are interpersonal relationships that may be going on between different people. There could be animosity between some of the people who walked in and some of the people who are already present. And so when we feel uncomfortable and we feel the energy of what's going on in a room, we look for reasons for this disruption. And we can blame the disruption on the mouse, because we can't, it's hard to name and it's hard to know those energy fields. And once again, the New Agey phrases, energy fields, auric fields, emotional dynamics, bioplasmic streamers. They try to have a vocabulary for this, but each group that studies it winds up coming up with their own terminology, because they're not science. They don't do laboratory experiments. We don't have proof. We don't have defined cause and effect that we can repeat over and over again so that we can say this is a similar to natural law. Now, where I'm going with this is I am trying to say that cause and effect has different layers, and as you include more information, you come up with the potential for different conclusions. So the deeper we can see into the reality of what's going on, the more information we have to deal with. But a lot of that information is, and I'm going to shortcut this, and I'm going to use the word known on a psychic level rather than a rational level. And by psychic, I mean something that you cannot see and you cannot prove. And psychic meaning that some people can be more aware of this reality than other people. So our levels of ability to perceive psychic energy vary. So when we try to have a discussion about what's going on in the room, we don't all have the same amount of information. And when I mentioned before that this becomes very dependent upon the person who has the information, upon their integrity, just because you have information does not mean that your interpretation of that information is valid or appropriate. So perhaps you can see that this gets very, very complicated very, very fast in terms of cause and effect. And that's why pathwork workshops and sessions focus upon your feelings, your awareness, and the objective feedback that you get when you act in the world. So the objective feedback is information. And objective feedback includes reactions from others. And the distinguishing point here is that we cannot know why someone, specifically why someone reacted the way they did. But we can characterize the reaction, and we can notice its effect on other people, including ourselves. So to some extent, it's objective because we do not know the source of the reaction, and we may never be able to know completely the source of the reaction. The only thing we can know to any depth of truth is what we feel, what's going on inside us, and how we find connections between cause and effect and our own behavior. Now, once you have that awareness, you can begin to notice cause and effect in other situations. So our self-knowledge can be expanded tremendously and be very useful in dealing with other people. But the development of that awareness, the actual learning of cause and effect on a deep level of truth and emotional reactivity, is best learned when we have access to everything, and the only place we have access to everything is in our own lives. And that's why the pathwork process winds up focusing almost exclusively on individual process. It doesn't do that because there aren't bigger problems. There certainly are bigger problems. And in preparing this presentation, I have been in the most terrible struggle because I found that, in my opinion, and I'm going to stress that very strongly and repeat it a few times so that everybody understands that this is my opinion and very vulnerable to my interpretation of mistakes. I believe that I have learned to observe people and myself, and I begin to see in the outer world cause and effect that I don't think most people see. I'm not alone. This is not unique to me. I'm not the oracle from the mountaintop. But what I'm expressing is that after decades of personal self-evaluation and then looking at clients and workshop attendees and working with people and working with my family and working with my friends in terms of working on me within my family and friends, I've learned a lot. And I notice things. I notice what I believe is cause and effect that are not as apparent, it seems to me, in the news reports, as my interpretation is. Now, I'm dancing around here a little bit because the unsanitary, dirty version is I know what's going on and no one else does. But I say that with a smile because obviously that's not true. But there are times when I think I do know what's going on, and I wonder about news reports, and I wonder about newspaper articles and feedback from people, because I see things so differently than they do that I wonder what's going on. And what I'd like to invite is, this may have some truth in it, and it's up to me whether I really perceive that as truth and decide to speak up, whether I decide to put my hat in the ring and say something, talk to my friends, write articles, write letters to the editor. That's what we do on a personal level. We decide how much interaction and how much, I'm not sure what word to use here, how much we want to engage with the world to bring our awareness and our opinion to other people's attention, hopefully for the purpose of allowing them to consider that there may be more going on. Now, I've been going on a bit about this because this lecture combines two key ideas, one about commitment. I'm speaking of cause and effect. And the commitment rests on cause and effect, so that's why I'm talking about cause and effect first. And what I'm speaking of is that the superficial cause and effect, when that is a quick analysis and it's not a true connection, then the conclusion that we make from that is flawed. So it is critically important that we are looking at the appropriate and correct cause, the actual cause, and the appropriate and actual effect of that cause, and not putting apples and oranges in a basket and saying they're both fruit close enough, they're the same, and moving forward with that kind of conclusion. Now, that's simplistic, but, rather than get into specific, I try to avoid getting into politics. I try to avoid getting into daily news reports, because we have the right to different opinions about this, and we all have different levels of information about it. So it's not a fair discussion in an arena like this. So I do try to keep it to what the lectures say, with the awareness that there's a bigger world out there, that learning cause and effect in your personal life has potential ramifications for your ability to perceive differently when you lift your gaze up and look out at the rest of the world. Just like once you understand your own personal dynamics, it is easier for you to see dynamics in the people who interact with you. Now, at this point, I'm going to pull it back to personal. I've had a difficult week. It was a very emotional week. I don't know why. There's no objective reason why this would be a heavy emotional week for me. So what do I do with that? Well, I have history. And I know that sometimes there's a confluence of things that don't seem related, but when they come together, they have an increased or magnified effect on me, more than I would realize. I have found this out by self-analysis from past situations. So when I started feeling depressed and heavy and emotional this week, that's what I looked for. I started looking for, well, what have I dealt with? And I identified that I was dealing with objective realities, but that also had emotional, emotional conditions, emotional things attached to them, would just be, or use tiny words. So I was dealing with three different situations, and they all had emotions and emotional content attached to them. And without realizing it, those three were related for me. And being a little bit non-specific, because it really does, the specifics do not matter here. But the net result was that instead of just feeling each one of the three, so if each one of them weighed an emotional pound, when I had 3 pounds of emotional pressure on me, instead of feeling 3 pounds of emotional pressure, it felt like 10 pounds. All of a sudden, it became magnified because the three were connected, and I felt things deeper than any one of those events would have led me to feel. I'm hoping that it makes some sense. But that's the unscientific, non-linear, confusing quality of self-examination. There isn't, I was going to say that there isn't anyone else, but an average person might not be able to help me analyze that situation. A trained observer, a therapist, a close friend might be able to detect that if I gave them all the information. But when we talk to people, we don't always tell them everything. Now, there's a lot in the news, not only recently, but in the last 2 years, there has been an extraordinary amount of revelation about people's personal lives. Famous figures, political figures, incredible amounts of revelation that show their public persona not to match their private persona. Okay? Well, that is human nature. Most people have a discrepancy between who they are as private individuals in the deepest part of their heart and the personality that they present to the rest of the world. Now, for some, this is the schism is larger, and that becomes a problem. But what I'm referring to here is that reality where we think we know someone because they've been in the newspapers or they've governed us for 20 years or we've seen their picture, we've met their wife. Oh, my God, how could this person be so different than I thought? I'm bringing this in because that schism is something that we may not be able to see in someone else. And so when we get objective feedback from them and when we interact with them, we may not realize that they are speaking from two different parts of themselves that are not in integrity. So when you get feedback from other people, all you can say is that's what they said. And this is my history with them. This is why I rely upon their information. All of this is objective. But when you look inside yourself and ask yourself, how do I feel? You have the possibility, you have the potential to know of the schism within you as well. You know about that discrepancy, about what you show in public and what you keep in private. Again, I'll give you a personal example. I mentioned to a friend the other day that I wasn't as perfect as they thought I was, and they laughed and said, "You're kidding, you haven't told me." Well, no, I haven't. Most of us have some parts of our past that we're not proud of, that we were not at our best, where we were, quite honestly, not terribly developed at the time, not terribly mature, and we made poor decisions, and we did not retract those decisions for a lengthy period of time. So So most of us have times in our lives where we're behaving in a way that today we would have a completely different opinion about and a completely different attitude towards. And they're sometimes so different it's night and day. You just simply would not be in that situation. A simplistic version of that is that for people who have held jobs for 30 years, that would make them about 50 years old. The kinds of jobs you held when you were 25 and 30, the kind of behavior that you tolerated from your boss when you were 30, the kind of carryings on that you might have done with your coworkers when you were 30, are maybe totally foreign to the person that you have grown into over the years. So that now you have a stronger sense of integrity, you have an established sense of work ethics, you have a limit on how you will be treated by superiors as well as coworkers, a certain level of respect that you demand, that you feel you have earned, etc. You get the idea. So that in a career span, If you took a video camera back to a moment when you were 26 years old and compared it with who you are now, it would look like it is a totally different person. And yet, the part of you that behaved like that when you were 26 is still part of who you are today. And it may actually be alive. And it may still act out on occasion, even though you've got it pretty much tamed and calmed down and no, we do not spit in the water cooler, we do not play practical jokes on our coworkers, but you may still have developed a very strong sense of humor. And you may still look for occasions or avenues where you can laugh and have a lot of fun in a way that seems more in integrity than it seemed when you were 26 years old. And there's a cause and effect to that. So let's say you meet up with somebody who knew you back then, and they consider you a friend, but they're not. I'm weaving a bit of a story here. I'm trying to stay focused on cause and effect. There's a reason why somebody might think that you are the same person. Because some people don't grow up. Some people don't change very much from the time they're 25 and 30 years old, and some people do. So when someone greets you and says, hi, how are you, and they want to enfold you in their life again, and they want to make you a buddy, and there's a strong pull, and you say, what are they thinking? Well, we're not seeing it from their perspective. From their perspective, they just lost track of you for a while. But you're the same person back then because they're the same person back then. From your perspective, you grew up, and what you see in front of you is an older version of your 20s coworker who used to play practical jokes. So when we look at cause and effect, it is important for us to be able to access the parts of us that we consider unsavory, where we did not behave well, where we may have done things that it's like we created a bill back in our 20s, and sometimes, even though we thought we got away with something, the bill comes due later on in our life. It's one way to look at the karmic or psychic quality of cause and effect. That dynamics that we set up early in our life affect the rest of our life. And the fact that we don't like what we did when we were younger doesn't destroy the dynamic. It doesn't dissolve the dynamic that we may have participated in setting up. And so later on, we may need to accept an effect in our later years, in our wisdom, that we would not have caused, but we did cause. Now again, we can get a little abstract here, And I don't usually do movie stories, but I'm going to do a movie story here because I think it would fit and be more concrete. A movie that I care about a lot is called Running on Empty. And it is a story about a man and wife who were part of the 60s underground weatherman-type movement back in the 60s. And they, in their youthful idealism, thought they would blow up a building, and there was a night watchman in the building, and he was killed. And instead of facing up to what they did, they had a small child, and they decided to run. And the story picks up 15, 20 years later, and they've been running for 15 to 20 years. They've been living underground with the assistance of other radical left-wing groups that believe they did the right thing and do not want to see them punished, who feel that they are all on the same wavelength. And they've been given, it's like going into witness protection program, only on an informal civilian level, and they would give them jobs and keep them from getting caught by the FBI. But now one of their children is getting ready to go into college. And that means that they would not be able to drop everything and move to a new city when the police came close. If this child goes to college, either they're going to get caught or they need to basically give up their child and allow him to go to college and never see him again. Now, what I'm describing in this story is a place where youthful enthusiasm We do something with useful enthusiasm, and we choose not to pay the full social price for it. I'm using the we because I'm talking about the story. And so we run. And in the running, it seems like we are living in our ideals, saying, I didn't mean to do it. I didn't want to hurt anybody. It was an accident, and I think society overreacts. So there's a justification process that goes on that allows people to feel that they are in integrity while not owning up to what they've done. But in the story, what brought them to a stop was love. It was love for their child and realizing that they did not want their child to give up a career because of what they had done. So the end of the story was that they turned the child over to the grandparents and knew that they could never see the child again because they chose to keep on running. They chose to keep on living a life where they did not meet society and pay the price. It's a very powerful story because most of us have done something in our youth, not quite this dramatic, not quite this powerful. And so the question is very universal sometimes. What if you had, and what if you had avoided paying for it? And now what do you do for the sake of your children? The questions are very, very interesting. And I'm taking the time to tell this in story form because this is what my experience is when I work with people on a deep personal level on cause and effect in their lives. That deep within us, there is a connection between the cause and effect of dynamics in our lives. The short version would be, there's a reason why somebody dislikes us. And in many, many cases, there's a place where we contributed to that reason. We may have wanted to give the impression we were on their side and then realize we didn't agree with them, but instead of speaking up about it, we just pulled back and wouldn't do chores, wouldn't answer the phone, wouldn't support them. And they felt betrayed by this. And so they got angry, which is another series of cause and effect, but you can't really, you only analyze one at a time. So that person gets very, very angry and becomes a thorn in our side and a problem in our lives. By owning up to whatever we contributed to become entangled with this. We have the potential for healing it. Now, healing it does not make that person not angry at us. That person has their own reason for becoming angry. But we can still be at peace with the situation. We can accept the consequences of having not spoken up when we should have, of trying to pretend we were somebody else, and in trying to extricate ourselves from that relationship or dynamic, we still didn't speak up, and we tried to dodge the bullet. And so the result is somebody else feels betrayed. Somebody else feels that we are not in integrity. There's a grain of truth there. So when you look into somebody's life and they say, I have this problem, my boss is always angry at me, the work that we do is to take a look at what the interactions have been with your boss. Well, you can say he's always been angry, and you know, it's he's always like that. He's like that to everybody. I just hate it. It makes me miserable. And this is where it gets a little tricky. This is tricky step number one. There are three or four other tricky steps to this. Tricky step number one, which I do to people, which catches them off guard a bit, is I ask the question, why'd you take the job? Well, I did an interview with that person. I never knew that they were like that. I just took the job. You know, it was just a random job. Or I got transferred into that department. Okay. Tricky question number two. Even if you found yourself in a situation that you do not feel you contributed to, what did you do about it? And I'm sure you can imagine all the justifications. What I'm suggesting here is that when we start off on the wrong foot and we don't do anything about it, sometimes things smooth out. But sometimes they don't. And then we wind up working in a company for 20 years with our 401k and our pension and our social dynamics and our career solidified into this company, and we've always hated the boss.
Good morning, Jan.
Yes.
It's David from Australia.
Hello, David. Welcome. Glad to have you.
Thank you.
So, it's good for me to kind of start over. I was out on an abstract tree limb here. So, we start off on a job, we start off on the wrong foot, and we don't say anything, and we just duck our head and say, I can deal with this. And 20 years later, we feel that we are wedded to, bonded to this situation in a way that seems almost impossible to extricate ourselves. And again, the question I ask people is, how'd you get there? But. Okay, when did you realize it was a bad deal? Oh, I just realized it yesterday morning. Ah, okay. Well, then, in a few days, you know, perhaps we could reflect upon what changes you'd like to make. But that's not normally the answer I get. The normal answer I get is I've been miserable in this job for 10 or 15 years. There are effects that accumulate upon causes that are based upon the effects of other causes. So you have archaeological compression of more and more things in a lifetime, so that by the time you say, this is not what I want, it usually takes quite a bit of undoing to get what you do want. And in that undoing process, where this lecture can help, is that we need to look with brutal, scrupulous honesty at our decisions, at how we contributed to the causes that have now become unbearable for us? Why did we take the job? Why did we continue when we were transferred into a department? Why didn't we take another job, even at less pay, in a more pleasurable environment with people that were more like us, had more integrity that we'd be happier with? For all the reasons, right or wrong, selfish or magnanimous, that we made all these life decisions, if we find ourselves in a position, backed into a corner, painted into a corner, where we don't want to be there, we basically, there's not much you can do except create change. And when you create change, it's like that's when the bill comes due. That's when the invoice comes due for all the decisions that you made that were short-sighted, not in your best interest, advantageous to you in one area, even though now you're paying for it by it being disadvantageous in another. All the times you said yes when you should have said no. All these decisions, all these actions of your own have assisted to create this situation. You are not totally responsible, but you are responsible for what you did. What this lecture offers is a guidepost, like a little lamp to carry with you, that basically says there is cause and effect. And sometimes the cause gets buried or disconnected from the effect. And we can feel as if it's not my fault, I didn't do it, the world is to blame, this person did it, that person did it. But if we can hold faith that there is always cause and effect, and we are dealing with an effect, and we open our eyes and soften our point of view and begin to honestly look for how we contributed to this, and I'm emphasizing how we contributed to this, because you cannot truly do anything about somebody else's actions unless they agree to change. But you can do something about your future actions. You can do something about your attitudes. And you can do something about your understanding of how you got where you are. Now, I've been talking about job history and stories because they're perhaps less emotionally charged, where a lot of cause and effect comes to play on an emotional level in people's lives is in relationship. And again, I have a nasty habit of asking clients who come to me with a problem, of asking, how long has this gone on? And I remember one client that basically said she knew the day before the wedding that she shouldn't marry this person. And you can imagine the pressures on someone with a wedding party, and she simply couldn't say no at that point, so she proceeded to marry. Well, that decision to go ahead, to in effect succumb to social pressure, to attempt to take responsibility for having created a financial burden on people for no reason, feeling responsible for having triggered this event, and feeling that completing the event had integrity, and yet out of the frying pan into the fire by trying to hold an integrity about a party, you jump into a marriage, and marriage leads to children, and children lead to mortgages and a life, and 20 years down the road, you have been dealing with situations for 20 years that weren't actually perhaps in your best interests, and where you now want to make changes and decisions. Well, it's harder to do that at 40 with the children and the house and the mortgage and the husband who seems to think things have worked out just fine, it would have been easier to cancel the wedding party. But, of course, in hindsight, we say that from a position of being 40 or 50 years old, of having lived life, of having experienced things, and having a far, far better understanding. So to some extent, what we do when we look backwards in time at ourselves is we are behaving like our parents would have behaved to us as young adults or children. And for the same reason, when your parents tell you you shouldn't do that, you say, yes, I should. I'm suggesting that rather than say I was wrong when I was 20, we might look at the possibility that we needed to rebel when we were 20, or we needed to get married when we were 20, or we needed to take a certain position that had a certain amount of prestige, and we didn't understand the ramifications of what would happen. And now that we are 30, 40, 50 years old, now we understand. And that ability to look back is not an accident, and it is not a problem. It is a gift. That by being able to see how we arrived at this moment in time empowers us. It makes us less a pawn in the game of life than, to some extent, the lead player in our life. By seeing where we contributed to things that later did not work in our best interest, we can now make new decisions that will lead us into areas that are more compatible with who we have become. What I'm inviting is that when we look back at our lives, the ability to use hindsight is, if we use that to punish ourselves and feel bad about who we were when we were 20, that's cruel. That's not the intent of the lecture. The invitation in the lecture is to, with love and charity for not having known what would happen, to recognize where you participated in certain decisions, to accept responsibility for having made choices, for untangling the effects that have happened because of those choices. And with that knowledge, then starting to make change. Now, in the beginning of this presentation, I spoke about losing track of cause and effect because we don't know what the truth is. So when I work with someone else, I have to be very, very careful because I may have a lot of experience as a therapist, but I can still make assumptions. And if I make an assumption about who they are and they don't protest or they don't see that I've made an assumption, I can lead them in a certain way of thinking or a certain way of analysis that may actually keep us from seeing the truth rather than help us from seeing the truth. And when we do personal self-analysis, we can do the same thing. We can go off on the wrong track. Like hindsight, there's not an inherent problem in that. It happens. And part of the task in following the suggestions in this lecture is, again, to be generous and loving to ourselves. That the first time we take a look at things, we may not see much. We may see a little bit more than we saw before, but not enough to tell us what's going on. And to understand that it is a process, not a black and white situation, and that enlightenment about your own life does not go on like a light bulb. It's a very, very slow, gradual process. Now, just quickly, I will mention that the other half of this lecture is about commitment. And the reason it's the other half is that the guide suggests that commitment is a... there's a simple quality to commitment, and that is to be focused on to have a one-pointed focus. And one of the reasons we don't have a one-pointed focus is we're trying to do two things at once, two things that are disparate from each other. So on one hand, he's talking about commitment, where your goals are split, and that's why you cannot commit wholeheartedly to a specific thing. And then he goes into the cause and effect to show where that split needs to be recognized as coming from some situation, some emotional dynamic, some confusion, something. It's coming from something. And to help you in going back and trying to find the cause for that split energy, and once you find the cause, you can make adjustments or changes, even if it's only a change in attitude, and come forward again and see if you can resolve the split in what you want. So that's why the two subjects are put together. Commitment isn't talked about as much as cause and effect is. But the truth is that if you really know what you want and you're clean about it and you feel confident that you are in integrity, that it's in your highest good and the highest good of people involved, it is so much easier to put all your effort into it, to hold nothing back. And that's how the guide describes commitment. Describes it as giving your all to something. And the phrase, if I can find it here, suddenly I've lost it. So he talks about commitment for a page and a half, and all the rest of the lecture is cause and effect. Because once you've got the cause and effect dealt with, and you know what you want, and you're not going in two different directions, commitment is, relatively speaking, easy. Also, you can take the opposite, that if you are concerned about commitment, there may be a grain of truth in that. It may not be time for you to commit. And that's based upon the fact that there's something else going on in you, and you would not be able to make a full commitment. And so the resistance to making a commitment is a message to you. It is the effect. Now you need to find the cause. Same thing is true of being willing and able to give a full-hearted commitment. That is the effect of your whole being in alignment. So I'm going to pause for a moment and do a minute of silence.